Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Sarah Westall, today we have a really interesting paradigm-changing episode where we're going to be talking to David Williams. He's actually a sovereign nation. He's a prime minister of his own nation. And he did it for a reason, and he's going to talk about it. We're going to start with the history of the United States and our Constitution. And also, he's going to talk about international law and how the United States fits into international law and how our laws fit that are completely different than the way we understand things. And he's going to explain all that. And he's going to explain why he became a sovereign nation. And he just gets in the tip of the iceberg on some of these things. So I'm going to have him back for a second episode to talk about international law at more depth. But this is the beginning of trying to understand the new paradigm of how international law is the supreme law of the land and how we fit into that whole matrix and why he became a sovereign nation so that he could get out of being under that and have immunity and be able to do the things he wanted to do without being arbitrarily thrown in prison and actually be able to make a difference. Very interesting. So let's get into that interview now with David Williams.
Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Sarah.
Well,
it's good to be here.
Well, good. I wanted you to join us. You have a very different paradigm in how you look at international law, how you look at our Constitution, and I think it's good to bring in completely different ways of thinking and get people thinking differently and just see what happens. But let's start with one of the things that you have been talking about. What major point about international law do you think people are missing?
Well, I know back in 1999 when I started down this path of studying law, because I was a businessman, and then there was a lot of problems with that we faced because of things that we didn't understand about probate, about IRS, about taxation, whatever. And my wife and I, at that point in time, we were living in St. Kitts in the Caribbean. We'd already moved out of here, but we had to move back because I had to take care of all these legal problems. And in the process of studying all of that, after 3 years, 4 years, it started. Well, I'll back up just a second. At the beginning of it, I finally decided to read the U.S. Constitution. And I would say that on average, I would guess that 98% of the population of Americans do not read the U.S. Constitution. They have no clue what it says. So therefore, and they don't read the real history around it and why it was formed. The Constitution itself said that international law was the supreme law of the land. And people don't take it that way because they'll read half sentences. For instance, Article 6, Clause 2 says this Constitution and, which is a plus sign, right, and all laws made in pursuance thereof, which means all 90 million federal laws that have been passed, and all treaties signed by the authority of the United States shall be supreme law of the land and shall be enforced by all the judges in every state. Now, since that time, I can tell you directly that there are treaties that have been signed where the U.S. has emphatically stated that international law is the supreme law of the land in all states. And they have agreed to that along with all the other nations that have signed on to it. So there's nothing new here. The founders of the USA knew this. And in particular, John Adams, if I had to would give any credit to like the one single guy who was the biggest prime mover of everything, it was probably him. At that time, and he was a lawyer, and even when you read his autobiography, Gibley, who was his mentor, because you had to be invited into the bar at that time to become an attorney, he just told him, he said, there's no such thing as a good lawyer that doesn't have a copy of the Law of Nations and a copy of a Book of Ethics on its desk. And so, you know, these were the things that I started learning that I didn't know because I simply was not reading the documents.
But and in law school today, lawyers aren't really trained in that. Is that correct?
They teach them what they want them to know. That's it. We've actually, I've had lots of conversations with attorneys Most attorneys now specialize in some particular field, just like doctors specialize in some particular field. A really good friend of mine I grew up with, he specializes in one thing, and that's workers' compensation claims. Any other law he doesn't really know or care too much about because he doesn't deal with it. We've also talked to attorneys that deal with nothing but IRS. And I remember one of our networker guys, he was talking with some attorney over things that he had done back in 2003. And the attorney called him in. He said, how did you get this done in the court? Because he'd never seen it done before. And he said, do you have your law books? Looking around the room and looking at the shelf, he said, do you have your law books here from when you went to school? He said, sure. He said, well, go pull them out into your IRS books. And it said right on the cover, Internal Revenue Code, selected sections. So they teach them what they want them to know.
Well, can you explain, let's get back to the Constitution. Can you explain the history of the American Constitution and how it was formed that most people are unaware of?
Most people, if you read the writings of Madison and you read the writings of George Washington and all those other guys, you remember, Sarah, you remember all this big talk about the arguments that were going on between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, and you had the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers?
Yes.
They tell us about it in school, just like me. I was told about it. I didn't ever read any of them until I started trying to figure out, okay, why is it I don't know this? And so it was always the question of why. And once I started learning it, once I read the Constitution, I remember there was a point in time when I asked someone around me at the time, I looked at them, I said, is it possible that everything I've been taught is a lie? Because nothing was adding up. Nothing was making any sense. Nothing that Madison had to say, nothing that Washington had to say. And this all stemmed from the Revolutionary War. And the thing that people don't know about the Revolutionary War was that they borrowed 18 million gold lira torno from the government of France and Holland and Spain to fight this civil war against their own king. Now, the difference with this civil war, so to speak, was they weren't getting out to say, okay, we're still going to be British subjects. They said, no, we're getting out by forming a new state. We're sick and tired of the tyranny. We have to break these political bands and form a new state, which is the way it's always been done throughout history. You have to move away from the tyranny, form a new state. In today's world, though, it's a little bit different. I won't explain that right now. There's not a requirement to move anymore. Used to, there was. And that was in the old Law of Nations. But these people understood the law. These were lawyers. These were judges. They were already running the governments for the king. In the House of Burgesses with the Virginia Company, the East India Company, the Philadelphia Company, Maryland Company, Hudson Bay Company, or whatever. So these guys already knew law. And not everybody was on board with what they were doing. The loyalists.
And we're not talking the Civil War. We're talking the Revolutionary War, right?
The Revolutionary War, right. Okay. Pre-Constitution.
I think you accidentally said Civil War, just to make sure that everybody knows.
They call it a Revolutionary War. They can call it whatever they want to. They were revolting against their own king. That is a civil war.
Okay, that's why call it civil. Okay.
Yeah, whatever you want to call it. These are just names that people call things. I really love the fact that they actually call it a civil war. Really? Civil?
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, it's like people calling, we were programmed to believe that republics are the best form of government. When you read the Law of Nations, all republics were called aristocratic republics because it's run by the aristocrats. And so when people say, well, we're guaranteed a republican form of government, it's like, was that like the People's Republic of China?
Well, they call it a democracy republic, right? A democrat republic.
Yeah, which the founders told them point blank it was not a democracy. They told them specifically it was not a democracy. So that's another program that we are taught and that we're preached to, taught in the schools.
So what did the founders say we are?
Well, according to the legend of what Benjamin Franklin said when he was asked, which he was asked by a woman allegedly in Philadelphia after the Constitutional Convention, sir, what kind of government have you given us? And he said, a republic if you can keep it. So they specifically were setting up, if you read the Articles of Confederation, they were specifically setting up confederated republics. That's what they, and there was a pattern of this in the Law of Nations that was patterned after some things that had been tried to have been done 2,000 years ago in Greece. These guys were very well versed in history and in international law and how these things had all occurred. If anything was going on at that time that kept people really in their position was another program that was running, another dogma that had been put down on people for century after century, which was the divine right of kings. You don't have a right to get out of the other king because he's divinely appointed to be, you're divinely appointed to be his slave or his subject or his servant, and he's your king. And so that generation, in my opinion, was like the first thing I see in history where they were kind of coming out from under that for probably like 2,000 years. They were coming out of it, of this doctrine of divine right of kings, even though, you know, we could have a debate about whether that still exists or runs today, which I believe it does. It's just not promoted that way anymore. Back then, it was blatantly the divine right of kings, and that was it. This the thing that they did, and I have to give the founders of the USA credit for one thing, no nation state had ever been formed by declaration before, not in the manner that they did it. And it was a declaratory act of them saying, look, we're breaking the political bands. We have to form a new government for our safeguards, and it's to this declaration that we pledge to each other, not everyone, each other. They didn't do it for the Native Americans. They didn't do it for women. Most of it was wealthy landowners. But we pledge to each other our lives, fortune, and honor to build the new state. That's why, going back to what I mentioned, they borrowed all that money, which in today's dollars, probably about $4 billion to fight this revolution. Now, whether they actually got the money or not is irrelevant. What people don't know about history, Sarah, is that they defaulted on all those loan payments. And so the Articles of Confederation had to be undone because it didn't give Congress enough power to actually make the states do anything. Once they formed up those states from being colonies, and I think I mentioned to you the other day, an interesting little side, if you do a little search on etymology, the word colony comes from coloni out of the Latin, and it means subject or slave, serf, which is where we get the word servant, okay? And so the colonies were, the British colonies were his servants. They now became, it said that we're going to be states, these 13 states, but they didn't do it for everyone. We said specifically to each other, they reaffirmed that even when they drafted the Constitution, we do this for ourselves and our posterity. Now, what is significant about that is most of the loyalists that were still loyal to the king, which was a lot of the wealthy landowners, once they did that Treaty of Paris and they agreed to pay the debt, but the king agreed that he would now treat them as sovereign and they could have the land. Well, at that point in time, a lot of the loyalists fled to Canada because they're like, well, now they're just going to come take our lands, which was true. That did happen. So there's a lot of history when you read it that's not there, and you can find it in writings like Tyranny Unmasked by John Taylor of Caroline, written in 1822. You can find it in Jubilee of the Constitution, written in 1839 by John Quincy Adams, who was the sixth president. That one is stellar in its explanation of what went on during those years. And you can find it in the writings of Madison, why they defaulted on the debt, what was the consequence of it, why they had.
So what was the consequence of defaulting on the debt at that point?
They had to guarantee to the international community, to France, Britain, Spain, and Holland, that those debt obligations would be met. When I read Washington's writings, I'll tell you this, he said, if you approach these guys about the requisitions to pay the debt from the king, they'll laugh in your face. Talk about the states guys and their legislatures or whatever. Well, those requisitions were agreed to be paid and they didn't pay them. As a matter of fact, James Madison said this, we have violated three treaties and we have violated the law of nations. Washington came back and said, yes, things cannot continue on in this train. What is to be done with these 13 disunited states?
Okay, so then what happened then?
Well, that's when they finally called for a constitutional convention because they had to guarantee those loan payments because they could no longer afford to fight a war. The states were at war with each other. There were tariff wars going on. They were back to infighting just like they had been before they did the Revolutionary War.
Okay, so then what ended up being put in the Constitution for us to pay back that debt? Did the states just pay it back? I mean,
No, they never paid it. But it's in Article 6, Clause 1, that all debts that were payable by the former Confederacy shall now be payable by the United States. Now, it's not written exactly that way.
Were there any consequences for us not paying that debt?
Well, the consequence was they had to form a more powerful central government to make the people in the states comply.
Okay, and did we end up complying? And if we didn't, what happened? We did end up complying.
Obviously. I mean, okay. And there was a lot of argument and debate over that. I can give you a lot of out of the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers, but one of the biggest anti-Constitution guys when they drafted the new Constitution. Now, let me back up just a second about this word Constitution. I don't care if they call it a charter. I don't care if they call it a Constitution, a compact, an agreement, a treaty. It doesn't matter. All of this comes down to one word, and that's contract. It was a contract. It's a compact that set up something. The original compact was not the Declaration of Independence. That was just a declaration saying what we're going to do. The original compact was the Articles of Confederation. Now, when you read Madison's writing, he tells and specifically points out 11 defects in those articles, which is the reason why the Constitution had to be redone and guarantee this debt. But, you know, when I read that thing from Washington, you know, he says, what is going to be done with these 13 disunited states? And if you ask these guys about paying the requisitions, they'll laugh in your face. I went, I bet the kings weren't laughing. So the kings of Europe were actually gathering back around and threatening they were going to come back and take the land if you don't get this debt paid and start making guarantees. So Article 6, Clause 1 guarantees that debt. And it also puts the U.S. back into that international situation again where they have to comply in Article 6, Clause 2, where I just mentioned that this Constitution and all laws made in pursuance thereof and all treaties made by the authority of the United States shall be supreme law of the land. That was one of Patrick Henry's biggest complaints, was that, well, they could overturn anything just by signing a treaty.
Well, exactly. So if treaties are done in secret, which we did just recently when we did that big treaty that no one knew about, and then Trump just turned it over, then they can pretty much declare any law a law without anybody knowing about it.
Well, here's the way a republic works, and this is the problem with understanding that if you don't have a right of self-governance, and just voting is not you governing. This is not self-governance. This is, if you look at the law of nations and you read international law and understand that, you know, I taught for 4 years on the web. My website was called Matrix Solutions, and I'll get into that in just a second about why I call it that. But if you look at any compact, any contract, I don't care if it's a corporate charter, I don't care if it's a corporation, everything comes down to the agreement. Everything comes down to the words on the paper. That's why it doesn't matter that Russia was called the United Soviet Socialist Republics. It's about the contract. Call it whatever you want. And so we end up doing things in corporate names or society names or whatever. I had a whole presentation I did called In Name Only. We do these things in this name. So going back to the compact called the Constitution, which is what it was, there were several complaints about it, especially by Patrick Henry. He specifically said, once you guys sign this, Congress could pass anything they want to under Article 1, Section 8, because the last clause says this that the Congress has the power to pass all laws necessary and proper. Now, I did an interview with Keith Hansen with Visigoth Radio, and I think I sent you that, but years ago, it was way back in 2010. I even asked, how is it possible to pass an unconstitutional law when all they have to do is say that it was necessary and proper, because they're not asking you what's necessary and proper?
Well, can you give us some examples? Like, give us an example of things that people commonly think is in the Constitution, but it's really not true.
That the Constitution actually defines any rights. That's the first one. There are no rights in the Constitution. Not any right whatsoever. Now they say, well, later on they did the Bill of Rights. I'm like, okay, fine. They considered those as some sort of amendment or whatever, but the Bill of Rights was not the Constitution. The Constitution and even the Confederacy, I mean, the Articles of Confederation, these are more like a compact or a charter of a business plan for how you're going to run things. Here's how long they could be in office. Here's how long they're going to do this. Here's the judiciary. Here's the executive branch. Here's the powers of the president.
Okay, so now let's explain the right to bear arms. Why do we not have the right to bear arms, even though it says that like that?
Because you're not party to the contract. Citizens are not parties to, I'm going to give it to you specifically out of the Palfrey case in 1854. This is in the Supreme Court of Georgia. And Palfrey was making a argument over inspection taxes that were being charged by the mayor and the city alderman in Savannah. So he made a constitutional argument about it. And the judge just said, there's several things in that case that are just absolutely stellar in the things that the judge said. He said, it is clear that the Constitution is a compact, and equally clear, you're not a party to it.
Mm.
Now, what he was meaning was that the men that formed the states were parties to it, because it says in there, those that made the Constitution considered themselves the sovereign and the government their subject.
So no one's alive today who was a party to it.
Yeah, but they left it for their posterity. Now, here's a little known thing, too, because a lot of people want to start debating at this point in time, like when they start hearing this kind of information, because this is unraveling, just like it did for me in 99. This is unraveling years of paradigms and programming that I had in my head that I didn't have there because I actually read anything. I had it there because somebody just told me this is what I was supposed to believe in. I was supposed to accept this as my truth, as my reality. And so when I'm reading this document, I'm going, wait a minute, something's not right here. And I want to look at some words. And it's interesting at that time, this is while we were in St. Kitts and I was on the internet, I found this little article called The Seven Deadly Nims. One of those was a capita nim. And a capita nim is, let's say, for instance, we take the word N-I-C-E, lowercase, we say that means nice, right? Uppercase, it's a city in France called Nice. So those men were absolute masters at wordcraft. And I mean masters. So when they said, we the people, that's capitalized in the middle of the sentence. We do this for ourselves and our posterity. Posterity is capitalized in the middle of the sentence. You're changing it from a generic to a specific number of people. In that case, the 39 men who signed the document and their posterity. Now, I can tell you this because I've met people over time that say they were posterity. One of them actually turned out to be the daughter of some granddaughter down the line of Zachary Taylor. Some of these people got outed from the posterity. They, you know, even John Adams disowned his own son, Charles. He didn't disown John Quincy. Obviously, he became the sixth president after his father was the second. So there's so much of this history that if you don't read it for yourself, you just really don't get it. If you don't understand some language procedure, I've actually had constitutional experts tell me that the Constitution itself was written at a 26th grade level. Okay, the average American now reads at a sixth grade level?
Okay, well, from practicality purposes, if everybody thinks we the people means all of us, how are they able to implement it, meaning only the descendants of a few people?
Because it's them using the government. They consider the government their subject, and therefore everybody who's under the government becomes their subject. There's no difference in international law. You can go read all kinds of books on compacts, and it'll tell you that the word citizen, subject, and national are all synonyms in international law. They mean the same thing.
Okay, so let's bring it back to practicality. How does this affect us on a day-to-day basis that'll bring some clarity to things that seem not to make sense, but with this it now makes sense?
Okay. Why do they not prosecute Hillary Clinton?
That's a great question. Why not?
Because she has political immunity.
How does she have political immunity?
Because she's held the office and they extend those immunities afterwards under their sovereign authority. This is going to actually be read in Articles 30, Section 38 and 39 in Book 1 of the Law of Nations. It says that the sovereign authority belongs to the people, but frequently they entrust it to a Senate or to a monarch. That Senate then, or that monarch then, is the sovereign.
Now, so if a state does something bad to another state, then you have to go do a war against them. So we'd have to do a war against Hillary Clinton and take her out physically in order for her to pay for her crimes?
I'm trying to understand what this is saying. But see, the answer to this is...
How does somebody pay for their crimes when they are immune? when states do something that's terrible to another state, you mm-hmm. have to declare war, or you do some kind of sanctions against them, or you do something.
You do something. Usually it's done by peaceful settlement of disputes, like what in the middle of declaration on.
What do you do against somebody who is a criminal, a human being who's a criminal?
Well, in the case that people in this country have agreed to these terms and conditions of immunity, international law is the supreme law of the land. Here, let me go back up a second on how.
So there's basically you're saying there's nothing we can do because that's the laws that we live under.
If the current administration that's
the
there
evil,
wanted to
evil, creepy Hillary Clinton can do whatever she wants because she's immune.
If they wanted to revoke her immunity, they already would have.
Okay, so they could revoke her immunity and then prosecute her.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, there is a way. Okay.
There is a way, but see, the bottom line of it is that let me lead up to where the reason that this is actually going on, because going back to what I said about this corporate charter called the Constitution, there's several things in here that Congress can pass all laws necessary and proper. Patrick Henry called that the sweeping clause. They can do whatever they want. And he said, in addition to that, pardon me, under Article 2, Section 3, your president will have the powers of a king. So I read that before I read the Constitution. That was the quote that made me read the Constitution. I'm like, wait a minute. Where is he as an attorney reading this document telling everyone that your president is going to have the powers of a king? Because what can the king do to his subjects? He can cut their heads off with no repercussions to himself for the protection of the state. That Senate then, or that monarch, is then the sovereign. There's no such thing as individual sovereign in the United States. And the states are not sovereign either. If you go back and read what I just read in Article 6, Clause 2, the judges in every state shall enforce international law and that Constitution, which meant state sovereignty went right out the window.
Well, and who isn't responsible for international law? I mean, who runs that?
Right now, the UN. But the UN is not the UN. The UN is not run by the UN. The UN is run by the Security Council, which is the permanent members, United States, United Kingdom, Russia, France, and China. Now, there's 11 non-permanent members that go on a two-year rotation basis, but technically they don't really have any say-so. And this is the element of understanding where all of this is headed. Is it okay for me to step aside real quick?
Are you going to show us something?
I am.
Yeah, okay.
This is my library. So, okay, sorry about that, I'm back. These are the things that I did study. See these? This is the third restatement of foreign relations law of the U.S., volumes 1, volume 2. Let me see, is this volume 1? Volume 1 here, it says, I think it's around page 26, says right in there that under sources of international law, and you have to understand that this is global now. The United States is the global player. They are the ones dictating international law today, not just U.S. law. Everybody wants to worry about their own little thing here at home. But if international law is the supreme law of the land, well, let me get into one of the violations that everybody on this planet is doing right now. Everyone on this planet is guilty because under human rights declarations, all the nation states have agreed to one thing. Under the rights and duties of man, it says that all men are born equal in dignity and rights and therefore should treat each other as brothers one to another. That was signed by the United States in 1933, as well as a whole bunch of other countries, a whole bunch of other nation states. I laughed as soon as I read it because I'm going, well, every one of them were guilty before the ink even got dry. Because not only do they not treat each other as brothers one to another, they don't do it even with their own societies. Look at this one. Look at what just happened. What was this thing in the news about some guy driving through a crowd and running over a woman and this stuff? So people don't know all the violations of treaty that they're guilty of or any contract they're guilty of, because here's what people believe. They believe I'm sovereign. I have a say-so. And yet you're subject to first municipal law, then your county law, then your state law, then U.S. law, and then international law. And international law is the supreme one. And when they pass a treaty, just real quick about how things work. Anytime they pass anything in private international law, I see it showing up in the U.S. codes, rules, and regulations because it runs from international law down into the code. There's this thing in international law they say that they're operating, and it's called the international public order. They're really trying to get to order. They really are. But they already know that people don't treat each other as brothers one to another, because is there any American on this planet that doesn't think they're better than the Brits? Is there any Brit that doesn't think they're better than everybody else? Is there any Australian that doesn't think they're better than the French, and the French think they're better than anybody in Ghana? All of this nationalism has just become a religion where everybody just thinks they're better than everybody else, and they're sold out for it. And this was the what I would call the magnanimous thing of the Declaration. They finally said, we're getting out from under this divine right of nations, kings, or whatever, and we are going to come out from under the tyranny by forming something new. Well, if the new thing then ends up becoming its own tyranny, guess what is left as a remedy for those that get tired of that tyranny? They got to do the same thing those guys did.
Well, are there two different constitutions?
No.
There's only one. There's only one. So when people are talking about the fact that there's two different constitutions, that's all BS.
It's all BS. They can't prove it. They can't form a document. And by the way, based on the sweeping clause that I just mentioned, where they can pass any law necessary and proper, they don't need another one. This was my interview with Keith. He said, well, what about all this vague language? I said, yeah, but so they can turn it around any way they want to in the future. And that's exactly what they did.
Is the Magna Carta the same as the American Constitution in the way that it's held under international law?
Okay, let's get into two things. The Magna Carta is a document that is no longer valid, because all the laws that have now superseded that is the same way as the Declaration of Independence. Now, the Declaration of Independence and the Confederation of States was superseded by the Constitution because they had no choice. When they didn't pay the debt, this is the big one. We've heard this phrase that the borrower's slave to the lender. Well, those debts came from overseas and they didn't pay them. They were in default on it. They had no choice. After 7 years, they agreed to pay those debts in 1782. By 1789, they were in complete default. They had to replace the government in order to pay the debts and get back in good standing. Now, whether people like it or don't like it, they'd like to castigate Alexander Hamilton, but Hamilton almost single-handedly revived the United States at that time. Otherwise, those foreign kings, if they didn't pay those debts, they were going back to war. He reestablished the credit of the United States so that later on they actually bought the Louisiana Purchase. So there's so much of this history that we're just not trained on. But as far as needing another constitution, if your president already has the powers of the king, why do they need to pass another constitution? That's just complete and utter what I call patriot fluff. It doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. It doesn't matter.
So some people believe that we do not own the United States. There's a higher owner of the United States. Who owns the U.S.?
The borrower is slave to the lender.
Well, who is that?
Well, right now it's the Federal Reserve, but that's run by the... If you look at the Federal Reserve itself, even the Supreme Court has ruled that that's a private corporation. Now, they say it's run by 13 families, those families being out of the inner city of London. And there's plenty of presentations you can go find about what I call the Empire of the City, the Ring of Power. It talks about the three city states that actually run the world.
Why can't we just take over the Federal Reserve and say, get out? This is our land, and we don't even recognize your laws.
Because they're the ones that passed it. They're not going to get rid of it. You'd have to get Congress and the president to all agree that that's going to be done, and that's not going to happen. If you go, there's a little document that I would recommend everyone read online, whether it's true or not, about who actually wrote it or didn't write it. The principles of what's in this document are absolutely what's happening today, and that document is called Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars. And in there it says that everything is being run at an international level by the international bankers in conjunction with all the presidents and heads of state. So they're not going to get rid of it.
Okay. So what else about the Constitution is a fallacy? What else about the way we run our government does the common person believe, but it's not true?
Okay. They believe that the United States is actually itself sovereign. And in Article 1, Section 9, I think it is, where it says the United States cannot assign any title of nobility. I read that and I went, why would any truly sovereign state Why would any truly sovereign nation deny itself the right of passing a title of nobility if they want to, or assigning one to someone? Because there are titles of nobility, and one of those is called Esquire. So why do we have Esquires in the United States? Well, if you read the article, it says that no private person shall accept any title, emolument, or president from any without the consent of Congress from any foreign prince or state. Something to that effect. But it says without the consent of Congress. Well, they're here, so apparently Congress must have consented, don't you think? So if Congress consented to them being here, then they're here, because the Bar Association comes from the what's called the Inn, originally out of Britain, and it's the British Accreditation Regency. It is British. So basically attorneys, I can tell you right now, I'm sitting in Jacksonville, Florida. We did the research on it. The Bar Association in Florida is a 501c3 outfit. It is not, the bar card is not assigned by the judiciary, the legislature, or the executive branch. The bar card comes from the bar.
Okay, well, what were we before 1913, before they created the Federal Reserve? Because you say the Federal Reserve owns us. Well, who owned us before the Federal Reserve? Because that's when everything really changed.
Well, it was still the same people, because if you remember, if we go back in time and we look at even the Constitution, one of the first things they did was they started the first Bank of the United States as a central bank. Although back then they still had gold, and they weren't putting all the same debt on there, except if you read John Taylor's book that I mentioned about Tyranny Unmasked, he actually mentions how much debt that they were continuing to run. It's really interesting reading like the first page where he talks about Congress and all the money they were borrowing and they were enriching themselves. Same thing that Patrick Henry complained about. And you look at it, what he wrote, and you look at it today and go, it's not changed. In over 200 years, the program has not changed. The Civil War, anybody that knows anything about this knows that war was not about slavery. That was just an ancillary issue. But Lincoln learned a lesson by financing the North with what was called the Lincoln Greenback. He did it without putting any debt on the Northern people or anyone. No debt. They were publishing, they were printing money with no debt. Well, he decided to keep that policy ongoing after the war was over, and we see what happened to him. Same thing was true with John F. Kennedy. He reopened the U.S. press instead of Federal Reserve notes, started producing a U.S. note again. That is not, but see, all the people have to agree with this. One person just can't come along and make the change. And so Kennedy, for all his, in Lincoln or whatever, for all their good intents or whatever, they're still in violation of international agreements when they try to do these things, and they execute that judgment harshly, as we've seen.
Well, they're trying to say, I don't want you controlling our country. And that's what they're trying to say. Now, you yourself is our sovereign state, right?
Yes, I took over a state that's a micronation back, it was formed in 1990, and I do have recognition from the U.S., Liberia, Uganda, Haiti, South Africa, we're working on it. I mean, one of the things that I told you earlier in our conversations, this was about learning how to be a businessman that could deal on a political level with immunity, so that I did business with immunity without having no immunities, because I see what happens to people in the U.S. when they don't have immunities. I mean, the number of my phone that has rung off the hook over for the last 15 years of people that have gone to prison for absolutely no reason whatsoever. You know, a lot of these agents out here that everybody thinks are in their best interest, they just want notches on their belt. They get promotions that way. So
that is clear. With my shows in Haiti and many of the shows that I've done, there is the do-good rhetoric is all it is rhetoric for many people. But anyway, so you were a sovereign state. Now, are you considered king?
No. I'm the prime minister. I rewrote their charter back in 2012 because after years of negotiating at the top, their president at the time, who had made an appointment to me as ambassador, he stepped down. And the original founder came to me. We had a meeting, and he said, well, will you take over this position? And at that time, he was still running around with a U.S. passport. I'm like, how are you running? I mean, I kept trying to tell you guys, you can't be dual at this level. Even on the U.S. State Department's website says U.S. citizens can even serve as a position of ambassador or envoy for another country if they need to. They do it with the U.N. all the time, where somebody may represent another country in a specific political capacity. but they only have that capacity in their job performance. Once they leave there, they revert back to that citizenship. So all they got to do is wait you out, right? And they're the ones making the appointment anyway. There's a difference in assuming responsibility to assume your own separate and equal station or do what's called the right of self-determination. That's completely separate. That's why international law is so magnanimous in this. It's the reason I call my website Matrix Solutions. It was about them getting out of that matrix system and then marching alongside of it parallel as Zion, when it's, we called it Zion, right? It had to be religious. They called it Zion, but it went along its way peacefully. As Neo said, I want peace. It went along peacefully beside the matrix as it rebooted for those that wanted to remain in the matrix. So there are so many international analogies I can make out of that one movie. It was absolutely stellar in how they did it. And I can tell you point blank, I don't know who wrote that story. It definitely was not the ones attributed to making that movie, the brothers. They were not the ones that wrote that story. There's too much international overtures in that movie that they would have never understood in the making of it. But they did a great job. I mean, I have to give them that. But as far as the movie itself and the script, they didn't write the script. There's too much stuff in there.
What is the name of the island that you are prime minister of?
Well, the nation state is called the Dominion of Melchizedek.
How big is it?
Well, the toll that we have claim over, that we were given a claim over, was in the Marshall Islands. So it's not much land. But states no longer need land.
Well, I'm just curious, like how big it is.
I don't know. It's like 5 square miles or something. It's just an atoll.
You don't need much land. That little area is a state.
Well, look at the Sovereign Knights of Malta. They have recognition from the Knights of Malta have recognition from 120 different countries, and they claim they have no land. Land does not form states. Land grows grass and trees, things like that. Men form states. And so in international law, and this is how everything runs in international law, it's all run by concurrent jurisdiction. And this is plainly obvious in this book I just held a while ago. When you look at the UN Charter, it says in here that the Security Council, that all nations have acquiesced in the principles that were put in by the Charter, at least most all nations, that's 194 nations. And the prohibitions against going to war are against all nations in the General Assembly, not against the Security Council. They, under Article 24 of the UN Charter, they are responsible for maintaining international peace. So what that means is that why does the United States have a right to go to Iraq? Why do they have a right to go in Iran? Why do they have a right to go into Somalia or Libya or any of these other countries? Where do they get the right to do this? It says that you cannot interfere with the political affairs of another station. So why are you interfering? Libya didn't do anything to the U.S. What did they go in there for? It was for human rights, a claim of human rights violations.
It's all bogus. It was a bank situation, I'm assuming.
It's by contract under Article 24, where it says the Security Council is responsible for maintaining international peace. And then by signing the UN Charter and agreeing to it, these General Assembly nations agree that in keeping international peace, that the Security Council represents them. This is nothing more than like a corporate stock proxy. You've given your proxy to somebody else. It's the same thing that we were talking about with the Constitution in a Republican form of government. You have given your proxy, just like in voting a stock up or down, to someone else. You technically have no say-so for 4 years, no matter what they do. You have no say-so. You can vote them out, or you can keep them in or do whatever.
How do we have the right to go in and just slaughter millions of people?
Technically, under law of nations, they don't. And the U.S. right now, even Putin is telling people that the United States is the biggest violator of treaties in the last 10 years. And it is going to come home to roost, in my opinion.
Okay, we don't have the right to kill people. And that was something that... Do you have any citizens?
We don't do citizens. Everybody that comes on board with us, it becomes a sovereign member, and they sign onto the charter, just like the founders of the USA signed their declaration.
Do you charge for that?
Of course.
How much do you charge?
I'm not getting into that. It's not a charge.
Okay.
They pledge life, fortune, and honor to build something new. Okay. It's no different than if I went out today, because I'm a businessman. We just started a brand new business. You and I talked about it because I love the name of your website, this business game changers thing. because I wanted to do business at an international level. I just watched too many men go to prison, and I'm like, I have got to find a way not to be under this yoke of having...
For going to prison for doing nothing, really. Just yeah. They want them out of the way.
Yes. And at the same time, now, I had... During this process, one of my problems was is I got up on their radar really high. I mean, I sued 4 federal judges. I sued 12 attorneys, 5 financial institutions, and 2 judges and 2 clerks of court under a RICO Act. And that's all had to do with me just learning probate law, because my problem was not with the U.S. Understand, I'm not complaining about the U.S. even in this. I'm only explaining how things run. But when I look at the president had the powers of the king, I'm like, well, do I want him to be my king? No. When Congress can pass any law necessary and proper and I have no say-so in that, do I want to be under that? No. Under Article 1, Section 5, it says that Congress shall keep a journal of its minutes and from time to time publish the same, accepting those things that they deem they should keep secret. They just gave themselves permission to lie. They can keep all the secrets they want. Well, is that a secret? No, it's not a secret. We'll tell you. What do you want to know? Well, yes, it's a secret. We just put out whatever...
Everything's classified, and they figured it's legal because they can say whatever they want because it's classified.
But when you agree to be under that contract and they have given themselves their permission to keep secrets from you, then you don't have a contract right to say anything. There's nothing left at that point. You have surrendered it. And that's the thing, just like I mentioned about a stock proxy. When you do that and you give it to somebody else in a company to sign it over or whatever, it runs the same way. It's really no different at a societal level. People have, like I mentioned a while ago, they have gotten into this nationalism thing where they believe it's a religion here to protect them. And it's not. It's business.
Okay, but let's get to something that... Go ahead. Continue.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
What does it look like these nations are doing if they're not doing business?
They are doing business. They're trying to take over and dominate and power, which isn't necessarily a business activity.
I disagree.
Controlling all the resources and having all the power and killing people to do it and different things. Yeah, business wants money, but you don't necessarily need to control everything to make the most amount of money. Businesses have different ways that they get accomplished things and do things versus dominating everybody and controlling everybody's mind and thinking.
Mm-hmm. Corporations now control 51% of the wealth of this company. Have you seen what like Exxon does in Nigeria and things like that?
I understand what they do, but not all businesses, to be a business, you don't have to run yourself like that. It doesn't necessarily equate to business. In that sense, right. Dominating and controlling everybody and controlling their thoughts and keeping secrets and bombing the hell out of other countries, that isn't necessarily business.
Let me say something about that. That was the thing that got me out of the U.S. When we moved to St. Kitts, it was specifically for that. I actually said, I will not pay another tax for these people to lie to me and go out there and start killing kids in other countries again. I looked at myself in the mirror and said, I'm guilty. I have supported this.
Nobody can convince me that is business. There's good business. There's bad business. There's criminals running business. Business doesn't equate to being a complete evil person that goes and kills people for whatever reason.
Yeah, but unfortunately, everyone's going along with the program. That's the problem.
A lot of people are asleep and ignorant.
But even the ones that aren't. This is the whole thing about, I mentioned silent weapons for quiet wars, and they specifically say that in there that people are hypocrites because whether they agree with it or not, they have given their consent to it by staying in it and by paying their taxes and doing all the other things that they do to support it. They want to detach themselves from it and say, well, it's not me, but unfortunately... International law being the supreme law of the land, there in the rights and duties of nations, it says this specifically. This is why I say it'll come back to haunt people in the end. And it is because it says that the federated state is viewed as a sole person in the eyes of international law. That means if one person's guilty, everyone is guilty. Well, and in the U.S., they put it right on your money.
But
right
what
on
about
the money.
What about people who are fighting it? What about me who is speaking up against the evils that we're doing?
Look,
you know, we don't know what to do.
I know, which is why I'm on this interview, because this is what to do. They put it in the Matrix movie. You have to get out. Whatever it takes, you have to get out. Now, that is a process. No, I didn't make that leap automatically either. And one of the things I learned even about moving to St. Kitts when I said I will never be involved in this again, we had the money to do it. We left. We were just, you know, we were just sick of it. We were just, I'd had enough. And once I started reading the Constitution and looking at, I tell you what got me back in 99. The real thing that got me was when I started seeing really that they are building, they now call them FEMA camps, but concentration camps. And we know that this is true. Now, I don't get into whether it's right or wrong, because if people are going to sit there like I did, I said, I can't do this anymore. I cannot pay this anymore. This is me continuing to agree with something, saying that I agree with it, and then doing it anyway. That just became an impossibility. I could not reconcile it anymore. Now, what I didn't understand at the time in 1999 was that leaving the geography did not get me out of the contract. It did not get me out of the jurisdiction. And we see repeatedly where the U.S. goes off for citizens that they consider in violation. They'll just run down to Costa Rica or Panama or wherever, pick them up and bring them right back. That's because it's considered now that you're property. You're a U.S. citizen. You violated U.S. law. We're enforcing extradition, global agreements, or whatever it is, and the international public order. And based on your contract, we're bringing you back. Whether it's right or wrong or anybody agrees with it, it still comes back to that contract.
Okay. One thing that you said about international law, that you need to treat each other like brothers and you can't go out and kill people. And so international law is, there's some good things about it, it sounds like.
There's awesome things about international law. I was actually called by the organization I mentioned earlier, and I was offered, this is in November of last year, I didn't get to go for it because I actually had eye surgery at the time, and I was down for 2 months and couldn't go. But I was asked to go to D.C. to have a meeting in their embassy to talk about doing humanitarian aid, which we're already doing. I've got a container of aid sitting on the docks right now, ready to go to Liberia. Because if you're going to build something new, the way you get recognition for building something new, well, how do any of these companies out here get recognition? They give away freebies all the time. Here, come on down, get free. We'll give away a free coat. Well, we started doing humanitarian aid because, number one, I do care about those other people. And number two, I realized that to build something new and get recognition for it, the easiest way to do it was to help other people out. So we've already got recognition from Liberia. 2 years ago, two and a half years ago, we sent them medical supplies for Ebola. But going back to when all this, you know, what you said about international law, I was called in November about starting a conversation on doing more humanitarian aid. I mean, I was offered quite a bit, quite a good sum for doing this. And because for me, it's business. It's just, I'm not here to worry about who's protecting me. My contracts will now protect me, my agreements, because I understand it. They also wanted to have negotiations and sit down and start talking about forming a human rights organization. And then they also wanted to talk about more, and let's get it on the books and more conversations started about landless sovereignties. They're already having conversations in the UN about recognizing cyber communities that don't have land.
Okay, so with this in mind, okay, we have 3.5 minutes here. With this in mind, I know we can't do it all in 3.5 minutes, but it is, it's the limitations of our, you know, satellite time. Okay, so with international law being what it is, we could use international law to force the United States to start behaving.
No.
You can't. Why? If they're
they
not...
They will do that eventually, but the first goal for the average person, that if they really are serious about this, they've understood anything that I've said today, and today is like the tip of the iceberg, because I'll tell you, one of the things I wrote back to you on email was Thomas Jefferson said it. You know, I did a presentation 2-3 weeks ago, and the guy said, you sound like we got to become a lawyer. I said, well, listen to what Jefferson said. You got to know the law. Ignorance is no excuse. And those that expect to be ignorant and free expect what never has been and never will be. My point about law is quit treating the three-letter word like it's some four-letter word. This is about contract. It's easy. And I'll tell you this, international law is not like the code. It's not written in all this legalese. It's written in plain English. It is so easy to understand.
Well, then what I need you to do is we're going to schedule another time, and you're going to go and walk through international law with us and what rights we really have and don't have.
Well, I also would like to, if we do it, I mean, I want to revisit this thing about, you know, because I called my website Matrix Solutions, and then after 4 years, we archived. I didn't have time anymore, because when I took everything over and I realized, okay, I now have to be the one to build this. When I say took it over, it was by agreement with the founder, because his duality got him put back in prison. And I mentioned this on the State Department's website, and I know we're up on time, but on the State Department's website, it specifically says that you could be an ambassador if you're a citizen for another jurisdiction. But if you're in a policy level position like head of state or minister of foreign affairs or whatever, it is incompatible with being a U.S. citizen. I had to surrender it. I mean, there was no choice for me. But I also understood that for me to do what I wanted to do, I had to, what those men did 240 years ago was a footprint for what can be done by anyone that actually learns this and takes it seriously.
Okay, well, we're going to have you back, because this is a change of paradigm for me, for sure. And I'm sure it is for many people. So I just want to understand it so that I can, so I can have a conversation that's intellectual.
Yeah. I'll tell you this real quick about the Matrix. And when we archived it, the DVDs can be ordered now. It's 22 DVD set for the 4 years of teaching I did. I sell it for a ridiculously low price of $997 for the 22 disc. And it goes through a lot of the things that we've talked about, because, you know, I tell everybody all the time, you got to unlearn before you can relearn. I mean, if you don't unlearn, if you don't deprogram, you cannot reprogram. And there is so much of this that was in the back of my mind that once I read it, I mean, it was like, you're looking at that entire thing, and that's the first thing that Neo had to do. They had to deprogram him to get him to learn that what he was in was something that he was just being told what to believe, all of his entire life being told what to believe versus actually learning what was the truth.
Okay. So we'll have that information up on your website or up on the show page and on video. It'll be displayed. And thank you so much for coming. We're going to have you back to talk about international law.
It's been so long since I've done this, and I actually do enjoy it, but it's like swallowing a pill like the red pill. It's really swallowing a pill. It is hard to swallow, quite frankly. It was for me way back in 1999, 2000, 2001. I didn't find this until 2004. It took me 5 years. I tell people today, I love teaching and training on it. We talked about it at the beginning of the show. I train on international law. Because people need training. And my job, I feel like, is to compress people's time frame and don't walk through that minefield where I had to walk through and watch all these body parts flying away because I didn't understand. I do understand now. And those footsteps I made are now there to avoid the pitfalls in the minefield.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. And you have a wonderful day.
All right. Sarah, thank you.
We're running out of time. Okay. Stay.
That's all we have for today. Very interesting conversation. We're going to have him back to talk about international law more. And then I'm working to get another person that is digging into this stuff as well. They have a little bit different perspective. It's kind of hard to get your head around if this is the first time you've heard it. I have been thinking about it for a while, and I still am working at trying to resolve it in my brain as far as how the whole thing works. And then how that works with common law. And what I understand is there is a common law that we work under, which is different than corporate law, which the country and internationally works under. But I don't know that for sure. So I'm getting different people, and we'll be talking to different people that will give us all different perspectives. But this has been absolutely great. And I want to remind you, if you like my content, please go to Patreon, Sarah Westall, and support the show. It really helps keep me going. I really need at least the costs covered for the show. And if I could make a little bit of money to cover my costs for the extensive hours that I put into this. But you know what? I do this as a passion. I do this because I absolutely love doing this. And I think it helps people. And I hope it helps people. So I want everybody to have an amazing Labor Day weekend. And we will have my show up again on Labor Day. So we will talk to you soon, and have a wonderful day.